Joe Biden gives the State of the Union.
Reflecting back on it, I can't think of anything big or new that was said last night. I think the bigger question is going to be, to what extent can Biden bring along the Congress and the American people?
Plus, a new proposal for getting humanitarian aid into Gaza.
The president said he is directing the U.S. military to lead an emergency mission to establish a temporary pier in the Mediterranean on the Gaza coast that can receive large ships carrying food, water, medicine, and temporary shelters.
And later, a new security law passes in Hong Kong, and Hindu nationalists are seeing an increase in popularity in Nepal. Today is Friday, March 8th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint, Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. U.S. President Joe Biden used his third State of the Union speech Thursday evening to announce a dramatic measure to facilitate aid into Gaza and to push for funding for Ukraine's war efforts. On the domestic side, he sought to highlight the differences between his administration and that of Donald Trump, his likely opponent in the November election. VOA's White House bureau chief, Patsy Wiedekuswara, has this wrap-up of what may be the most consequential speech ahead of the president's re-election bid.
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
Like many American presidents in the last year of their first term, President Joe Biden delivered his State of the Union address with a key goal in mind: to convince the American people he deserves four more years.
Tonight, we can proudly say the state of our union is strong and getting stronger.
He addressed voters' concerns about his age and mental acuity, turning it into an attack against former President Donald Trump, the presumptive Republican nominee he's likely to face in the November election.
The issue facing our nation isn't how old we are, it's how old our ideas. Hate, anger, revenge, retribution are the oldest of ideas. But you can't lead America with ancient ideas.
While it's not technically a campaign speech, Biden had a clear message to voters. Trump is a dire threat to democracy. The president invoked the January 6, 2021 storming of the U.S. Capitol by Trump supporters seeking to overturn Biden's victory in the 2020 election.
My predecessor and some of you here seek to bury the truth about January 6th. I will not do that.
As Israel's military campaign raged in Gaza, Biden announced a dramatic measure to deliver much-needed aid for Palestinians.
Tonight, I'm directing the U.S. military to lead an emergency mission to establish a temporary pier in the Mediterranean on the coast of Gaza that can receive large shipments carrying food, water, medicine, and temporary shelters. No U.S. boots will be on the ground.
It's unclear whether the plan will be enough to appease progressive Democrats, Arab and Muslim Americans outraged by Biden's unyielding support of Israel. Hundreds protested outside while he spoke. Biden underscored Israel's right to self-defense against Hamas while calling for a temporary ceasefire and the release of hostages held by the militant group. And in a rare rebuke to Israel, he expressed frustration over the lack of aid and the 30,000 death toll in Gaza.
To the leadership of Israel, I say this: humanitarian assistance cannot be a secondary consideration or a bargaining chip. Protecting and saving innocent lives has to be a priority. As we look to the future, the only real solution to the situation is a two-state solution over time.
Biden's foreign policy goals have been overshadowed by House Republicans' obstruction of a Senate-approved $95 billion foreign aid package to help Ukraine in its fight against Russia. Biden urged them to pass the bill.
My message to President Putin, who I've known for a long time, is simple. We will not walk away.
Biden urged Congress to pass a bill on immigration and border security, a key issue for American voters. He laid the blame for the deadlock on Republicans and Trump, accusing them of exploiting the border as a political issue.
We can fight about fixing the border, or we can fix it. I'm ready to fix it.
He vowed to protect the right to abortion and in vitro fertility treatment, a top concern for Democrats amid conservative states restricting access.
Many of you in this chamber and my predecessor are promising to pass a national ban on reproductive freedom. My God, what freedom else would you take away?
Biden also touted his policies, calling the American economy the envy of the world. He laid out a progressive economic agenda targeting corporate America and the wealthy.
No billionaire should pay a lower federal tax rate than a teacher, a sanitation worker, or a nurse.
Alabama Senator Katie Britt delivered the Republican response.
President Biden just doesn't get it. He's out of touch. Under his administration, families are worse off. Our communities are less safe, and our country is less secure.
The data shows the economy has exceeded expectations, but inflation remains a major concern of voters, creating a potential weakness for Biden ahead of the election. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News, Washington.
For more analysis on Biden's State of the Union, I'm joined by Michael O'Hanlon, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution.
First of all, he did show he's got some endurance. And frankly, there are some of us who feel that presidents of both parties for the last generation or so have given speeches that are way too long and way too unfocused and become litanies of all the different things that presidents want to do as opposed to good speech work unto itself. And I thought that the speech began very well with very clear articulation of the stakes involved in defending Europe, in helping Ukraine defend itself, in preserving democracy at home. And I thought if the president had stayed on that theme and added a couple more and been done in a half hour, it would have been a much better speech. However, apparently White House speechwriters don't think that way. And this has little to do with Biden. This is more a characteristic of modern American politics, that these speeches do become, you know, places where captive audiences listen to an exhaustive and exhausting list of policy initiatives. Those kinds of speeches just do not carry that much power for most of us. And I don't think very many people watch the whole thing.
Well, for the substance of his speech, did he meet his objectives? Did he get his point across?
Well, yes and no. I mean, there were a lot of points there, but because they were diluted by this long litany of various ideas and initiatives, by the end, it was hard to remember what he had said at the beginning. And so, again, I don't think that's so much about Biden. I think that's the way modern American State of the Union speeches come across. And I don't mean to be venting at the expense of your audience, but I think audiences who may not have watched the speech need to know they have a lot of company, because Americans are getting tired of these speeches. They're not compelling as real clear explanations of what a president's priorities are, because they include just so much that you lose your way.
The ideas there are nothing new. Support for Ukraine, support for Israel. But he is facing increasing domestic pressure on both those fronts. How did he address that pressure from within his own party in Israel and from Republicans in supporting Ukraine?
My sense, and again, it's just my sense, we'll have to see how the dynamics play out in coming days. My sense is that even though I completely agreed with President Biden on the Ukraine issue, I don't think he made any fresh argument, apart from just the rhetorical drama of invoking FDR from that same location, you know, some 80 plus years ago on the eve of World War II. That was an effective rhetorical device, except, again, it was lost by the fact that it was more than an hour later before the speech was over. And so on that one, I don't really think he made much progress. However, on the Gaza issue, he at least proposed this specific initiative for increasing humanitarian relief flows into Gaza. It's a good idea. It's probably an overdue idea. It's going to mitigate the humanitarian concern. It's going to prove the United States, you know, is symbolically and substantively doing something about the Palestinians there more than we have so far. But it's not going to change the fact that the war is still ongoing and that people are still dying. So it'll take a little bit of the edge off the anger in some places. But the only way for Biden really to recover politically on this issue is for the crisis to end, for the fighting to end, and for some kind of political vision emerge for the future of the Palestinian people. Until that happens, I don't really think he's in anything besides damage limitation mode.
Speeches like this, especially in an election year, are as much campaign speeches as they are traditional States of the Union addresses to Congress. How did he set out the differences between his policies and his administration versus those of Donald Trump?
Well, I think that in this case, you know, he made a lot of specific comparisons. He talked about how we struggled with COVID under Trump and have emerged under his presidency, for example, which was a, you know, partly fair observation. But of course, Trump was president when COVID arrived, so it was bound to be a little bit slow at first. And Trump at least should get more credit for the vaccine program, even if not for the broader response on public health. And so there were things like that where, you know, Biden had the floor, he had the podium, and so he could make all these specific comparisons. Another one was obviously on Ukraine, where Trump has shown indifference not only to the Ukrainian people, but even to U.S. NATO allies who are not spending enough on their militaries. And Biden made that point and quoted Trump's, you know, horrific comments of a couple of weeks ago that Putin could go ahead and do whatever he wanted to American allies who were not meeting their stated, you know, goals or obligations under the NATO alliance. And, you know, Biden pointed out that's not just really impolitic, it's dangerous, because if Trump really were to invite an attack on NATO, then it's not that clear how or why we wouldn't get involved in responding. And so inviting a little bit of aggression against an ally is potentially going down the path to war. So on that kind of a point, Biden made good comparisons, accurate comparisons, and very reasonable ones. But again, I would say you're in a country where the partisan divide is already pretty strong, where people have already lined up pretty clearly into Trump and Biden camps, and where a long speech like this is not necessarily going to leave people with two or three takeaways they still have on their minds this morning or going into election season. So I think in that sense, it was more of a test run for certain arguments than it was, you know, a major campaign speech. As you say, the State of the Union speeches are always relevant in an election year to the politics of that year, but people don't really get completely focused on campaigns until at least the summer or even Labor Day. So, you know, with Trump out there, there's always political theater that's ongoing all the time, and Biden responds to that. So in one sense, the politics never go away, but they really only tune up the volume or turn up the volume fully in, you know, most American voters' minds later this year, at least summer into fall. So I don't know that this speech would have had big takeaways for the campaign.
For people watching the speech in Brussels, in Kyiv, in Moscow, in Jerusalem or Rafah, is there anything new for them?
The newest thing is the pier, the temporary pier for humanitarian relief in Gaza. On other issues, I think, you know, the news cycles have been bringing almost all the ideas already into the fore. And so I have to go reread the speech, because, again, the danger of giving such a long set of remarks is that people start to forget and messages get diluted. But reflecting back on it, I can't think of anything big or new that was said last night. I think the bigger question is going to be, to what extent can Biden bring along the Congress and the American people on some of the big ideas he's pushing? And to what extent can he bring along the Netanyahu government in Israel on some of the ideas he's pushing there, not to mention Hamas itself? And so I think the speech didn't resolve much. It's going to be a question of reaction to the speech, and we don't yet know.
Michael O'Hanlon is a senior fellow and director of research and foreign policy at the Brookings Institution. Mr. O'Hanlon, thanks very much for your time. Thanks for your analysis this morning.
My pleasure. Thank you.
As we've heard, much of President Biden's State of the Union was devoted to Ukraine and pressuring Republicans in Congress to pass the legislation to continue supporting Ukraine's defense. VOA's Anna Chernikova is in Kyiv, and she has this look at how the speech was received there.
President Joe Biden began his State of the Union address this year talking about freedom and democracy under attack, calling it not ordinary moment in history, addressing the case of Ukraine and comparing the war against Hitler with the war against Putin. President Biden once again called on lawmakers to support the draft law on aid to Ukraine and other partners after months of uncertainty and speculations around it. Here in Ukraine, Biden's speech was received positively. The society was pleased that Ukraine was brought back to the spotlight, giving hope the support will continue. However, Ukrainians who continue to defend freedom and democracy at the battlefield are looking for actions rather than words. While Russian forces continue to advance at the front line and Ukrainian cities remain under constant shelling every day, the U.S. support is considered crucial for the country to survive. Meanwhile, Ukrainian military is working on stabilizing the front line and improvement of their defense positions, while Russian forces continue to advance in the Donetsk region and intensify the offensive in the Zaporizhia region. The Ukrainian military officials admit the lack of ammunition and say they are running out of air defense capabilities that could also affect Ukraine's ability to defend territories deep inside the country. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
One of the few new initiatives unveiled in the State of the Union was the building of a temporary pier in Gaza to allow for the U.S. to bring in more humanitarian aid. VOA's Linda Gradstein has reaction to this and other parts of the speech from Jerusalem.
President Joe Biden says the U.S. has plans to help solve the humanitarian crisis in Gaza. The president said he is directing the U.S. military to lead an emergency mission to establish a temporary pier in the Mediterranean on the Gaza coast that can receive large ships carrying food, water, medicine, and temporary shelters. No U.S. boots will be on the ground. This temporary pier would enable a massive increase in the amount of humanitarian assistance getting into Gaza every day. Israeli officials said they welcome the initiative, and Israel will do whatever is necessary to help the U.S. Israeli officials also were pleased by the president's remarks that the current crisis began with the massacre of 2,000 people in what was the deadliest day since the Holocaust. But Israelis were less happy about the president's insistence that Israel must change its policy on Gaza. The president said Israel must also do its part. Israel must allow more aid into Gaza and ensure that humanitarian workers aren't caught in the crossfire. Biden underscored that humanitarian assistance cannot be a secondary consideration or a bargaining chip. Protecting and saving innocent lives must be a priority. He said the only real solution is a two-state solution. Israel has rejected the two-state solution, saying it would compromise Israel's security, and Israel says it must be responsible for security in Gaza. Just a few hours before President Biden's speech, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu repeated his intention to continue the war into Rafah, the city on the border with Egypt, where more than 1 million Palestinians have fled fighting. We will continue until total victory, Netanyahu told new army officers, and that includes Rafah. Israel asserts that Hamas leaders, including Yahya Sinwar, are hiding in tunnels below Rafah, perhaps surrounded by some of the hostages still in Gaza. The U.S. has been trying to mediate a ceasefire and had hoped to do so before the Muslim holy month of Ramadan begins next week, but that now seems unlikely. Linda Gradstein, VOA News, Jerusalem.
You're listening to Flashpoint, Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Hindu nationalism is on the uptick in Nepal. We'll go there in a few minutes. Now, though, in Hong Kong. On Friday, the government unveiled its proposed national security bill following a month-long public consultation that ended last week. City leaders want it to be passed swiftly, potentially within weeks. Some lawyers analyzing the draft said at first glance elements of the revised sentences for the offenses are similar to Western ones, but some were broader and potentially tougher. Eric Lai is a fellow at the Center for Asian Law at Georgetown University.
It seems the government almost ignores all of the recommendations from the opposing views during the consultation period. The vague and broad terms of offenses and definitions remain in the bill, and there are much tougher sentencing, tougher sentences. If crimes are related to colluding with foreign forces.
Under the proposed law, the court can deny the rights of arrestees' choice of lawyers, which can be problematic in the principle of fair trials. The bill includes sentences of up to life imprisonment for treason, insurrection, sabotage, and mutiny, 20 years for espionage, and 10 years for crimes linked to state secrets and sedition. Again, Eric Lai noted Hong Kong's freedom of expression and other rights.
It also put the court into a difficult position between the public interest of disclosing information and safeguard national security, given the high pressure from the political environment, and given the fact that the the chief executive can impose a certificate to determine state secrets in the course of a trial. And the judges handling these trials are designated by the chief executive as well.
A previous attempt to enact similar security laws in 2003 was shelved after an estimated 500,000 people staged a peaceful protest. And finally today, in Nepal, a growing Hindu nationalist movement is calling for the country to adopt Hinduism as its state religion and reinstate the Hindu monarchy. There's concern over recent clashes between Hindu nationalists and police. Analysts say the movement stems from a combination of disillusionment with the government, inspiration from neighboring India, and social media influencers. Henry Wilkins reports from Kathmandu.
Pushpa Raj Purush runs an ashram in Kathmandu and is also a social media influencer with tens of thousands of followers on Facebook. He teaches Hindu values that he says are being lost in Nepal. Purush says every country has its own identity and unique traits like language, culture and traditions, pointing out that Nepal grew out of the Hindu tradition and the world should recognize it as a Hindu nation. Nepal is 80% Hindu. Purush is a vocal supporter of the Hindu nationalist Rashtriya Prajatantra Party and tells his followers Nepal should adopt Hinduism as its state religion and reinstate its Hindu monarchy, which was abolished 16 years ago. Purush is one of many Nepali influencers, promoting a wave of Hindu nationalism that analysts say stems from disillusionment with the government. Santosh Sharma Padel is with the Nepal Institute for Policy Research.
I think there are multiple reasons for that. I think the first and foremost, the kind of political leadership that we expected from a Republican secular state, we haven't got it.
Nepal became a democracy in 2006, and observers say many Nepalese have not seen the development they had hoped for under a federalist system. Hindu nationalists are harnessing this frustration. Asked if Nepal's Hindu nationalist movement takes inspiration from neighbouring India, where the Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party, BJP, has been in power for almost 10 years, Padel replied,
"That has definitely provided the spark for sure."
Hindu groups in Nepal have denied claims repeated in a US State Department report that religious groups associated with the BJP in India provide money to influential politicians of all parties to advocate Hindu statehood. India is in competition with its geopolitical rival, China, for influence in Nepal, which borders the two countries and is strategically important for both. Influencers like Pushpa are having a major impact, say experts. Josh Bose wrote a paper on the rise of Hindu nationalism in Nepal for the Global Network on Extremism and Technology.
There's lots of posts online pertaining to Hinduism in Nepal, the desire for a Hindu statehood in Nepal, which have thousands of likes.
In November, police broke up violent pro-monarchy protests after Durga Parasi, a prominent online influencer, urged followers to take to the streets. Some politicians say they are concerned about the rise in Hindu nationalism, while others, even from the usually secular Communist Party, are seeking to gain political points by aligning themselves with the movement. Henry Wilkins, VOA News, Kathmandu, Nepal.
And that's going to wrap up today's show. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com. and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until next week, I'm Steve Karish.
Stay up to date with VOA Podcasts. Each weekday, International Edition covers the world's biggest stories, while Flashpoint Iran and Flashpoint Ukraine examine their respective regions in depth every week.